Welcome back to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have F. Roger Devlin on the show. He is a prominent academic philosopher and American. Would you call yourself a white identitarian? Is that correct?
Identitarian. I have used that term.
Okay.
Sure.
So to make sure I'm not misclassifying, misidentifying you. Or you are also the author of Sexual Utopia and Power. A book which
that's what I'm best known for, writings on feminism and the sexual revolution, yes.
Yeah, in that book you take on, I guess you advocate for traditional monogamous marriages, relationships, and also what I noticed in that book is you take on the issue of hypergamy and point the finger at women mostly for a lot of the...
Mostly, well, it's a response, I call it an unorthodox defense of orthodoxy.
Uh-huh.
Which is, in other words, it's not really based on traditional moral authorities, but mostly on evolutionary psychology.
Yeah.
But it explains through, you know, that means it explains the nature of what actually happened in the sexual revolution and explains why it has been badly misunderstood by a lot of traditionalist conservatives.
Mm-hmm.
And it does, yes, it does end up by defending traditional monogamy as an unsurpassable system and a social good, yes.
Yeah, yeah. So and I guess it's influenced much of the so-called red pill community,
yes,
right?
Yes, apparently it's, at one time it was Counter Current's best-selling title. I think it's behind the White Nationalist Manifesto now, but it still has been very influential. It's been very gratifying to me.
Great. Well, tonight I have you on to talk about a provocative article you wrote. At least the title is very provocative. The article is well argued and written. The title is Hitler
the Peacemaker.
Hitler the Peacemaker.
Yes.
So, wait a second.
Well, yes, I'm not an authority on modern history. It's not really my subject. I saw this book. I was actually, you know, I usually attend the American Renaissance Conference, and
mm-hmm.
this last summer I was there, and I saw Mark Weber carrying around an advanced copy of this of a book that the Institute for Historical Review has just republished in a greatly expanded and improved edition. It's called The Forced War: When Peaceful Revision Failed, by David L. Hogan. Hogan was an American historian who died in 1988. He wrote this book back in the early 60s, and it's essentially a diplomatic history of the events leading up to the outbreak of World War II in September of 1939, when Nazi Germany invaded Poland. And the picture that emerges from the archives is enormously different from what we've all been led to believe. Now, I haven't looked in the archives myself. I'm not an expert on the subject, but all I've done in this article is to take a 700-page book by Hogan and tried to condense the main argument in about 13,000 words. It was printed on it was posted on countercurrents.com as a 5-part series, and it sort of tries to reduce this story of 2 years of very complicated diplomacy to a single chronological narrative. The only real predecessor, I guess, that Hogan had in this in writing such a book was A.J.P. Taylor. You may have heard of him and his book, The Outbreak of the Second World War, I think it's called.
I think Origins of the Second World War. Right?
Origins, yes, that's right. Origins of the Second World War. And that came out, I think, in the 50s. And AJP Taylor was, you know, he had a track record as being, rather negative on Germany and the Germans in his view of modern European history. But he decided that it was high time that somebody actually look into the diplomatic record. And what he found was, he reported what he found, which was very exculpatory of the Germans. His thesis was basically that the Anschluss, the annexation of Austria and of the Sudetenland, were not stages on a pre-planned policy of aggression, but rather just adaptations to circumstance. It was not planned in any way. It was just that Germany was just reacting to the actions of others, and that is the opposite of what had been said at the Nuremberg trials. Of course, the basic story of Nazi Germany that was presented at the Nuremberg trials, and that still kind of, you know, strongly affects people's views to this day, is that Hitler came to power in 1933 with the idea of launching a war of aggression, and that the annexation of Austria and the annexation of the Sudetenland were simply stages along the way, and so was the invasion of Poland in September of 1939. Well, Taylor found that that was false, and then Hogan, the American historian Hogan, looked even more deeply into the archives and told a story that's bound to be shocking to anybody who hasn't studied the matter in great detail. But in the story as he tells it, the most important father of the Second World War was actually Edward Wood, 1st Earl of Halifax, the British Foreign Secretary at that time, and secondarily Josef Beck, the Polish Foreign Minister at that time, both of whom basically boxed Hitler in and made it impossible to avoid a European war. Hitler and his lieutenants did more or less everything they could to try to avoid war, and it's a fascinating story. It's like it's like a lost chapter of history. It's been buried under an avalanche of propaganda, but I think it's very well. You know, the his book is extremely well annotated. Hogan had a flair for languages. He even was able to read the Polish archives. And this new edition, it's got hundreds and hundreds of notes. So it's all very well attested or
sourced.
Yes, very well sourced.
Mm-hmm. So he did the sort of the drudgery, the painstaking effort going through the diplomatic records, and what emerges is a competing narrative. In fact, sort of a upturning of history. What we accept the narrative of Hitler starting this sort of inexorable process of conquest, the desire for world domination. We find out that this is a leader who thought basically to secure Germany's place on the continent, not necessarily even dominate. He wanted to come to a modus vivendi with France and, of course, Great Britain. But those powers proved intransigent for various reasons. And there is the, of course, there was the blank check with Poland, which sort of you could say gave Poland the incentive to reject any offers from Hitler.
Correct. The story really begins, I guess, with the end of the First World War. Before the war ended, first of all, there was no Poland on the map of Europe. Poland was swallowed up a little bit by Germany, more by Austria, and most of all by Russia in the late 18th century. And as a consequence of the First World War, well, two important things happened. First, a large new Polish state was created, in part by taking a great deal of land from Germany, and second, the German-speaking part of Europe was chopped up. Germany itself suffered punitive losses of territory. They lost Alsace-Lorraine to the French. They lost little bits to Belgium and Denmark. The whole Austrian-Hungarian Empire was broken up, creating this Austrian rump state that still exists, this little German-speaking state of several million people separate from Germany.
Because this was Hitler's home country, right?
That's right. That's right. And the people, the German speakers of the old Austrian Empire, overwhelmingly wanted to join Germany. That was an old idea. You know, the German lands had been united under Bismarck, except for those in Austria. And so, in a way, the end of the First World War and the breakup of the Austrian Empire created the possibility of finishing Bismarck's work and uniting the German speakers into a single state. But Germany lost, and Austria was their ally on the losing side. And so, the victors were determined not to allow this. They forced the German-speaking Austrians to live mostly in this rump state that still exists, that they did not want. They forced 3 million Germans to live in a new state that they called Czechoslovakia, which had never existed before and which amounted to a kind of Czech empire.
And no longer exists.
Yeah. Right. At the time, you know, the Czech leaders promised the victors at Versailles that they were going to create a kind of a Swiss-style confederation where there would be a broad autonomy for the different groups, because you had Czechs, you had the Slovaks, you had Germans, you had some Hungarians and Poles as well, even ethnic groups that some people may not have heard of, like the Ruthenians in Eastern Slovakia. And so they stated it as their purpose to create a kind of decentralized Swiss-style confederation. What they actually did was create a highly centralized state where the Czechs ruled over everybody else, including the Slovaks, and nobody except the Czechs themselves were happy with it. So that was, and as far as Germany was concerned, there were 3 million Germans living on the kind of the edge of the Czech lands, the area known as the Sudetenland, which is sort of the rim of the Czech lands that adjoins Germany. So anyway, Hitler did want. Now Hitler never intended to try to get back every square inch that had ever been German, and he certainly had no intention of trying to take over Europe. His goal was to try to. As a kind of a compromise between the whole of German territory and the punitive reductions of German territory imposed by the victors at Versailles following the First World War. Germany lost an awful lot of territory, and he wanted to bring at least some of it back. And so in 1938, the year before World War II broke out, he had two opportunities to do this. First of all, the head of the Austrian government, a man named Kurt Schuschnigg, announced a plebiscite in 4 days' time. It was not possible to organize a legitimate plebiscite in that amount of time. But he announced a plebiscite within 4 days in March of 1938 on whether to join Germany and on the question of like a vote of confidence in his own leadership. And this was apparently intended fraudulently. The question about his leadership was phrased in a way that made it difficult for the voters to understand, and there was no secret ballot. It was all very suspicious. So Hitler and the Germans announced that they were not going to put up with this. They delivered an ultimatum, and when Schuschnigg rejected the ultimatum, they demanded that Schuschnigg resign and install the head of the Austrian NSDAP. a man named Seyss Inquart. And so Germany, the German army invaded Austria, and this is like just 2 or 3 days after this bogus plebiscite was announced, with the idea of putting Seyss Inquart in the prime minister, to make him the head of state. But the rejoicing from the Austrian people was so wild and so seemingly unanimous that Hitler simply decided to annex the territory. And all of this happened within 4 days. It was totally unplanned by Hitler. If Kurt Schuschnigg had not announced this bogus and apparently fraudulent plebiscite, Hitler would not have sent in the troops and would not have annexed Austria. It was not, the record is clear that it was not pre-planned. It was not simply a stage on a plan for conquest, but rather a response to sudden events that, you know, that Hitler himself didn't determine.
Now, this detail is important, but it was totally missed when I watched. It wasn't addressed or dealt with when I watched The Sound of Music.
No, certainly not. That's a very, very good piece of entertainment, but it is not history. And, a few months after the annexation, the annexation of Austria brought, 6 or 7 million Germans into the Reich again. So it was enormously popular.
Well, it's consistent with the principles of self-determination spelled out by, I think, one of Wilderolson's
right.
14 points, right?
That's right. And this is something that the Germans were promised when they signed the truce agreement in November, but the victors imposed something different at Versailles, and it didn't actually end up in the treaty. So the Germans were lied to. And this is one of the reasons, people wonder, how did anybody vote for Hitler? Well, frankly, one of the reasons is that his party was the only party that totally rejected the Versailles Treaty. They viewed it as something that was enforced by violence and fraud, and therefore not morally binding. And so, Hitler's moves in 1938 to bring back 10 million Germans into the Reich were extremely popular.
Mm-hmm.
A few months after the annexation of Austria, a very similar series of events occurred in the Sudetenland, where 3 million as soon as Austria was annexed, the 3 million Sudeten Germans in Czechoslovakia were wild with excitement, and the Czechs made a big mistake and tried to claim that the Germans were concentrating troops on their border. And this false accusation was an attempt to sort of confuse the international community and get British and French support. And it didn't work. The British figured out very quickly that there were no troop concentrations on the Czech border, and so as a response to this fiasco, Hitler determined that he was going to settle the matter by force if necessary in October of 1938. And there were a number of unsuccessful negotiations. The British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain flew twice to Germany unsuccessfully, and then on the 28th of September, just 3 days before Hitler's deadline, Mussolini suggested a conference between the French, the British, the Germans, and himself, the Italians, in Munich. That became the famous Munich Conference. And this is one of the most mythologized events in 20th century history.
Oh, yes, the lessons of Munich.
Yes. Supposedly it was a betrayal of the Czechs and a particularly terrible example of cowardly appeasement of Nazi aggression. In fact, Here's what Hogan writes. I'll actually quote from my review briefly. Never was an agreement more clearly in the interest of all powers concerned. Britain won time to continue to gain. The only reason that Britain didn't go to war over Czechoslovakia was they thought they weren't strong enough yet. They were behind, particularly in aviation and in the matter of bombers. So the so-called appeasers, such as Neville Chamberlain, were actually trying to buy time to build up their military forces before attacking Hitler. They were already following an anti-German policy.
Yeah, long-range bombers are inherently offensive weaponry. So.
Oh, yes. Yeah. They were beginning in 1936. The British were making long-range bombers with the idea of bombing German cities, you know, German civilian areas. The Germans, they had a few bombers, but they were much smaller, and they were what you would call tactical weapons.
Yes.
So
the Heinkel,
anyway,
Yeah.
But in any case, what happened at Munich was simply the world refused to go to war over Czechoslovakia. And the Sudeten, all areas in Czechoslovakia that were contiguous with Germany and populated more than half by ethnic Germans, were handed to Germany. So Czechoslovakia continued to exist for a few months, but with the loss of a significant amount of territory. And the Munich Conference brought 3 million more Germans back into the Reich. So that was for a total of something like 10 million in the year 1938. Two astounding diplomatic triumphs. And then in the following year, Hitler wanted some kind of a similar agreement on the issue of the Polish corridor, and he wasn't allowed to get it. The British and the Poles refused any concessions. And so there was no repeat of Munich, and the world was plunged into war. That's the basic story.
Yeah, there is again, you mentioned Polish intransigence, because this is done at the urging of the British, and some say even the Americans, mm-hmm. the Roosevelt administration.
Yes.
But in the article, it states how Halifax was there to make sure that there were no terms. No peaceful successful peaceful negotiations to the point that Britain was looking to start a war, to foment a war with Germany. And people ask, why would Britain want to fight a war with Germany? Well, this was in the period, a 30-year period, First World War, Second World War, that some have called the Second 30 Years War, that Britain sought to destroy German power because it was becoming dominant on the continent. And long-term British strategy dating back centuries was to make sure that there was no dominant power on the continent. And one time it was France, then by the early 20th century, it switched to Germany. And that's what the First and Second World Wars were about. This is the balance of power that was written about.
Balance of power strategy. Yes. It's an old idea. It can be found in Machiavelli, and Hogan devotes a whole chapter to it, really, showing that for a period of something like four centuries, this is what has driven British policy. The basic idea is to oppose whoever the most powerful country is on the European continent. Now, if you just look at a map of the world in 1930s, the idea of accusing Germany and Hitler of wanting to take over the world is obviously preposterous. At that time, the largest power in the world was Britain itself. It still had this empire on which the sun never set. Second to Britain, of course, was the Soviet Union, Bolshevik Russia, occupying, 13, 14 time zones, stretching from the edge of Europe to the Bering Strait. Again, absurdly larger and more powerful and more menacing than Germany. All that Hitler was doing, rather than trying to take over the world or even Europe, he was trying to consolidate the German-speaking population of Europe into a nation state. It was, would seem to be far less of a threat to the world than either the British Empire or Bolshevik Russia. But the hold of this balance of power thinking on the British led them to treat Germany as an enemy as soon as Germany started to become powerful again. Partly, one of the main problems is, Russia occupies a large part of the European continent, but is traditionally viewed as not being a part of Europe. And it was also, the power of Russia was seriously, seriously underestimated by a lot of people at that time. Russia had an absurd regime that could barely feed its people. Stalin had just finished shooting 20,000 or more officers of the Red Army. And Anthony Eden, Churchill's protege, actually made a statement in the 1930s that Soviet Russia wouldn't be capable of waging an aggressive war for another half century. And all of the people involved, Halifax, the Polish government, they all underestimated the danger of communist Russia. And that's really what brought the Second World War about. They miscalculated and thought it would make more sense to ally themselves with Stalin against Germany than to ally themselves with Hitler against Stalin, which would have made much, much more sense in balance of power terms, even as well as in, securing the well-being of Europeans. Hitler seems to be one of the few people who understood this. He actually offered rather generous terms to the Poles because a Polish-German alliance would have been able to stand up to the Soviet Union. I believe the two countries' populations together were almost as great as the Soviet Union. If Britain and France and Poland and Germany had united their forces, Stalin wouldn't have had any chance. Instead of ending up taking over half of Europe, he ended up as the real victor in the Second World War, of course.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and even when you get the leader of Poland at the time was Beck, which is what most people think is a German name, it shows you.
Yes, it is a German name. There's a lot of mixture like that.
Beck cross pollination there, which means it would be favorable to a natural alliance, right?
maybe that it's not uncommon to find German names in Poland and Czechoslovakia and Slavic names in Germany, as I noticed when I was living in Germany.
Yeah, you had Alsace-Lorraine, a lot of Germans with French names and French with German names in Alsace-Lorraine.
Sure. Yeah.
It's the nature of the area.
There's a lot of that. Beck was actually the foreign minister of Poland, but he seemed to have a pretty free hand in foreign policy. As according to Hogan, Halifax did in Britain. According to Hogan, Neville Chamberlain took the lead up through about the time of the Munich Conference in determining Britain's foreign policy. But after that, he sort of handed the reins over to Halifax. Not everybody agrees with this. Mark Weber actually thinks that Hogan doesn't it goes too easy on Chamberlain.
Mm-hmm.
In any case, the view that Chamberlain was some kind of cowardly appeaser is utterly preposterous. He wanted to go to war against Germany. That was his intention. He signed the Munich Agreement because he thought that the UK needed to buy some time. And in the 11 months that intervened between the Munich Conference and the outbreak of World War II, the British did in fact pour an enormous amount of treasure into building up its air defenses and its offensive capabilities in aviation as well.
Yeah, it was them that started the terror bombing, and
that's right.
In order to provoke Germany to bombing London, which riled the public or coalesced or organized the public against Germany to prolong the war. Because
right.
Of course, even before and even during those stages of war, Hitler offered several olive branches or peace offerings that were rejected.
Yes, and one of the things that Hogan uncovered was that just a few days before the outbreak of the war, Hitler even promised the French that he would he would not bomb any civilian areas, provided that his enemy, you know, that his enemies didn't. And of course, the British quickly ensured that that condition wasn't fulfilled. So, you know, that's why the war turned as bloody as it did.
Yeah. Well, that's true. Even the much of the destruction that occurred in France during the war occurred during the period of Allied liberation, 1944-45, and not during the occupation. In fact, that was relatively mild. And from all accounts, German soldiers behaved rather well during their occupation period.
Well, this goes well beyond what the period covered by Hogan.
Yeah.
So I can't really say much about that.
This is
a diplomatic history. We still haven't come to the diplomatic negotiations between Poland and Germany in the months leading up to the war, which is really the central subject. Hogan saw what happened in Austria and Czechoslovakia as a kind of a template that might have occurred again if others had been willing. If, you know, Hitler offered fairly generous terms. He did not demand the return of the Polish corridor. Following the First World War, Poland was granted a strip of land that cut East Prussia off from the rest of Germany. And this is something that caused intense resentment among the German people. As Hogan says, there's no government under the Weimar Republic accepted this. They all hoped to win back that corridor and to reattach East Prussia to the rest of Germany. Hitler was actually willing to accept the corridor as long as Poland was willing to grant him two things: a kind of a favored communications route, a highway and a rail link between East Prussia and the rest of Germany, and also for Poland to acquiesce in Germany's annexation of Danzig, which is, as Hogan says, the least defensible provision of the Versailles Treaty. Danzig was an ordinary German port, a provincial port that, under the terms of the Versailles Treaty, was made into a sort of a mini city-state. It was detached from Germany without being granted to Poland, and it lay geographically between the Polish corridor to the Baltic and East Prussia. And nobody was happy. As I put it in the article, this arrangement succeeded in sparking the covetousness of the Poles while preventing its satisfaction. So Hitler was not asking Poland to give back Danzig, because Danzig wasn't Polish. It was under a League of Nations, some kind of League of Nations mandate, a very complicated and a sort of arrangement that nobody was happy with. But he did demand that the Poles acquiesce in give up any claims they might have to Danzig, because Hitler wanted to reintegrate it with the Reich. That still would have left Poland a corridor to the Baltic, however. Hitler was one of the few people in Germany. He had the most moderate position of practically anybody in the German government on this issue. Most of the Germans wanted to get back at least some of the territory that had been ceded to Poland under the Versailles Treaty. Hitler was happy with a communications route and Polish acquiescence in the annexation of Danzig. He made this offer to them shortly after the Munich conference. Beck adopted delaying tactics for a period of about 5 or 6 months. And then in March, a series of events occurred which kind of formed the immediate background of the Second World War. It's a little complicated. What sparked the conflict was a dispute between the Czechs and the Slovaks. Slovakia declared independence. Germany recognized it. And then Germany sent troops into the remaining Czech lands. He did this for a couple of reasons. There was a danger that an actual war would erupt between the Czechs and Slovaks, and wanted to make that impossible. And the Czechs were also continuing to pursue strongly anti-German policies. So he ordered Hitler ordered the occupation of the remaining Czech lands in March. I guess it was March 15th, 1939. This was the occasion on which Halifax and Beck in Britain and Poland, respectively, came out openly in intransigent opposition to Hitler. Beck completely rejected Hitler's offers and broke off negotiations, and the British also came out at that time with their blank check guarantee to Poland, which made the Polish feel able to follow a policy of intransigence toward Germany. The Poles were they badly overestimated their own power. Poland had then and has now a population, I think, about half that of Germany. Their armaments were much, much weaker. They had, let me see, what are the examples that he gives? They had about one-tenth or so of the armaments that Germany had. But war fever gripped Poland, and they actually imagined that they could defeat Germany. And they even, some of them even said that they would go to war with Germany, even with or without the British.
Reckless.
Yeah, very, very reckless. Very delusional about their own powers.
Didn't he also order a mobilization?
Yes, in March, the Polish government ordered a partial mobilization to beef up the troops, and So that was a turning point. The Poles also there was a lot of persecution of the German minority in Poland. There was very little done against the ethnic Poles living in the German Reich, but there got to be a sort of a war fever in Poland during these months between March and August of 1939.
And Czechoslovakia basically disintegrated. That's why they had the protected Bohemia and Moravia, right?
That's right. Yeah. Slovakia became independent. It was recognized by the Germans, and so Hitler occupied the Czech lands. He did say that he was that this was just a temporary arrangement, and he was perfectly happy to have any kind of government in the Czech lands, provided that they were not, making their country into a base for aggression against Germany.
At the same time, in Poland, you have these negotiations, and again, Hitler would have been happy just to secure Danzig. He had no designs in conquering Poland, part of his vast empire.
Not at all. He demanded no actual territory from Poland. Poland would retain sovereignty over all the territory granted to it by the Versailles Treaty, but would under Hitler's proposal would grant like a certain special German rights to a small strip of territory, not sovereignty, but special rights for transit purposes, for a highway and a rail link between East Prussia and the main part of Germany.
Now, all this is occurring in Central and Eastern Europe. And why are France and Britain concerned? There's no legitimate defensive national security interest.
Well, yes, right. It's the balance of power thinking again. Yeah. That's apparently what actuated Halifax. Halifax had always been, already at the time of the First World War and at the end of the First World War, he was advocating a very strong punitive stance toward Germany. And his actions as foreign minister were were consistent with that, and they were certainly partly also motivated by the increasing power and prestige of Germany under National Socialist leadership.
Yeah, and also, of course, a few years prior, 1935-36, Hitler had rearmed the Rhineland, of course, emphasis on the rearmed, meaning that this was German territory, but it was mostly a defensive posture. The Siegfried Line was defensive works, right?
That is true, yes. Yeah. What the Germans called the Westwall, or usually known as the Siegfried Line in English, was defensive, and this is something that, you know, it's a point that Mussolini tried to make to Chamberlain and Halifax, but they were determined to go to war, so they didn't listen.
They simply ignored all of Hitler's overtures.
That Hogan makes is that the anger about the Jewish policies in Germany were really largely a screen, a pretext, rather than a real motive.
Mm-hmm.
The motive was to destroy Germany because Germany was becoming the most, as they saw it, the most powerful country in Europe. That's, as I say, it's only true if you don't count Soviet Russia and Britain itself as part of Europe.
Yeah.
Right. Either the British Empire and Soviet Russia were both more powerful than Germany, but they saw Germany as the enemy simply because it was the most powerful country in between, you know,
well,
by this point.
What had occurred in 1870 when Germany was unified, after the Franco-Prussian War, you had this massive industrial power develop, rail lines, industrial capacity, a massive trade union, if you will. And this became an economic competition to the British Empire. And this is when, I think, well, some people say this is sort of the hidden grammar of the First World War, was Britain seeking to knock Germany down a couple pegs economically and also geopolitically, because they didn't want to compete with them economically. They couldn't compete with them economically anymore. And so they decided to go to war. And, of course, the pretext, of course, is the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand and all the intrigues that lead to the outbreak of war in August 1914.
But that was all a product of balance of power thinking.
Yeah, this is the Mackinder doctrine. I think Halford Mackinder had come up with that theme, which is still in play today, by the way. We can see it. We can see some of the similarities of recent events, basically invoking Hitler in Poland in regards to Ukraine and Putin, and a similar provocation occurring in the past 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
But we can talk about
later.
Sure. Yeah. We have this that going on in the summer of 1939, bad faith negotiations, Poland being intransigent because Britain is encouraging them to. You have the blank check, which is basically investing in Poland, whether or not Europe goes to war, which is really stupid. But you have August 23rd, 1939, the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact.
That's right. Yes, the last days, the last week or two leading up to the Second World War take up a lot of time in Hogan's book. It's a very detailed record. Fascinating story. Hitler's generals told him that it would be impossible to launch an attack on Poland after September 1st because it would take a month to conquer Poland. They'd have to allow at least that much time. And in October, at that time, Poland still had mostly dirt roads, and the country became a sea of mud. So they couldn't delay military operations past that point. So what Hitler was trying to do in August and into the first couple of days of September, he was looking for a way to settle accounts with Poland by itself without involving Europe in a wider war. That was his goal, and Halifax and Chamberlain were determined that he would not be able to accomplish that. Hitler and Stalin, basically, they did not form an alliance. That's a misconception. There was no real alliance between Nazi Germany and Soviet Russia. But there was what's called the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, signed just about a week before war broke out, was a delimitation of spheres of influence. Essentially, the two countries drew a line down the map of Eastern Europe, and Germany agreed to not to interfere with anything that Soviet Union did to the east of that line, and Stalin agreed not to interfere with anything that Germany did to the west of that line. So essentially, they divided up Poland, and
so it was a reversion back.
Hitler hoped that this would, you know, having this agreement with the Soviet Union, having this would scare the British out of pouring resources into the protection of Poland, but it didn't work out that way.
He didn't understand the British balance of power geopolitical thinking here. He thought there's some good faith effort to maintain peace.
He, as Hogan puts it, he overestimated their rationality. You know, he saw that it was not in Britain's interest to go to war, and he figured they won't go to war. And there were some. He also had some indications from German intelligence that to the effect that the British might not. He didn't know. Up until I think the 28th of was it 20 no the 20 25th, he originally intended to invade Poland on the morning of August 26th, and he offered the British an alliance, and he really thought he could settle the Polish matter militarily without involving the rest of Europe in war. But a number of bad things happened that on the 25th, and rather than accepting his alliance offer, in fact, the British signed an actual treaty with Poland that day, obliging them to come to the Poles' assistance in case of an attack from Germany. And so Hitler actually made a very last-minute cancellation of his war plans. The war should have broken out on August 26th instead of September 1st. Okay. But Hitler was convinced to make one last effort to make peace with the British, and there's a very detailed rather exciting account, actually, of the last maneuvers, Hitler's last maneuvers to try to maintain the peace in Europe and settle the Polish issue separately between just, you know, Germany and Poland. But of course that was unsuccessful, and the war broke out. War broke out on September 1st. But even at that late stage, it was not certain that it was going to result in a Europe-wide conflagration, because although Britain had extended this guarantee to Poland, privately they didn't think it was possible for them to make a go against Germany without the support of France. And France was not keen on declaring war against Hitler at this time, and that's one of the most fascinating chapters in Hogan's book, is the bluff that Halifax had to use to force his war through in spite of French opposition, and eventually he succeeded in carrying the French along with him.
But it is interesting that
they declared war on the 3rd. The 3rd of September is when Britain and France declared war on Germany.
Yeah, one point is Britain makes this guarantee or promise to Poland to come to their defense should they be attacked or go to war. I think even Poland had the privilege even starting a war with that under the terms of the agreement.
Yes, it was not limited to a defensive war. Mm-hmm. They would support Poland in any war with Germany.
And it turns out they didn't have the capacity nor the intention to come to the aid of Poland, because they didn't.
Well, they weren't going to do it without French support.
But then the French
say this publicly.
Yeah, but then the French don't do anything for 7-8 months, and then in May 1940, Hitler rolls west, and that's not aggression.
That's right.
They were already at war.
This, this too is outside the scope
Yeah, but just shows
of
you the bad
Hogan's.
faith of it all.
Yes. The early phase of World War II in the West is the period known as the Phony War, because the British and the French did not do a whole lot, and they didn't really do a lot until Hitler invaded France in May of 1940.
Yeah. So it's one of these things. Oh, you know, it's so. So Hitler thinks he gets this pact with Russia, a non-aggression pact with the Soviet Union, rather, and that's there to deter British, but he overestimates British rationality and their understanding, what their objectives are. He does say that should a war break out, that will lead to the destruction of the British Empire, and he is correct in that estimation or that prediction. That does occur.
It was a pyrrhic victory for Britain. The only real victor in the Second World War was Stalin. That was even the clearest victor of the Second World War.
But the big thing I always try to remind people is that the outbreak of a general war, this conflagration that destroyed Europe, at least as a major power center, independent power, led to all that destruction, tens of millions of dead, the destruction of these beautiful German cities. And it resulted because France and Great Britain declared war on Germany. Germany did not declare war on them.
And, that's right.
Yes,
that's right.
And so that's what that's you, this focus on this these couple year or year 1938-39 is very important.
1938-39,
because it's so misunderstood, and the narrative is so cartoonishly ridiculous. What we get in the standard history, even when we get at college level courses, I didn't hear any of this.
The Nuremberg trials were essentially they were like Stalinist show trials, and they laid down a kind of official version of the history of World War II that's completely counterfactual, and it's only thanks to the labors of men like A.J.P. Taylor and David Hogan that we can correct this now. And what actually happened.
I got familiar with it reading Chamberlain's book, America's Second Crusade, and then there was Beard's book on the war that regarding Roosevelt's intrigues, and then there was also, of course, Harry Elmore Barnes. Who actually Hogan was familiar with. I think they had a falling out, but over their scholarship, whatever. But he wrote a book called Perpetual War for Perpetual Peace. Actually, it was a compendium of various articles about a lot dealing with a lot of this stuff, and it was really eye opening. But I didn't come across this until early 30s, mid 30s. I was reading this material just on my own.
Right. Well, I was late coming to it too.
Yeah.
But if we've been talking now for over an hour, let's wrap it up. Let's just tell people you can find my article on Countercurrents, or nowadays it's on the IHR website. They link to it. It's done as five installments. It's really a single review in 13,000 words. It seems pretty long. It's one of the longest reviews I've ever done, but we're talking about a 700-page book here.
Yes, it was a very good review. Lengthy review. All five parts are
on
UndReview.
One
article. Yeah. Before I let you go, any comments? A lot of people have drawn a parallel between the events of 1938-39, Germany and Poland, and Ukraine in 2022, the provocations.
Well, ever since 1945, this has been the template for all our foreign relations. Everybody that we don't like is always the new Hitler, and any attempt to deal with them rationally is said to be appeasement and a failure to learn the supposed lessons of Munich, an entirely fictionalized account of what actually happened at the Munich conference.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, right now Putin is the latest Hitler, and they're comparing this creep, this dictator in the Ukraine, to Churchill.
Which
you read Hogan, you find out that even Churchill wasn't Churchill.
Yeah, I know. He's like might be apt in a way they don't intend.
Right. Yeah.
The comparisons and all that. Yeah, they showed the provocations, the bad faith negotiations, the preventing of Ukraine from negotiating with Putin regarding this.
Yeah.
The parallels are there. I guess the purpose of this revisionism that we're discussing tonight is perhaps we can get to a point where people, instead of us calling everyone a new Hitler, people refer to people who foment wars, were scheming
Yeah.
behind the scenes
The
as.
new Halifax
There we
was the
go.
new
Yes, the new
bat. Yeah.
Halifax.
Yeah, yeah,
That's
yeah,
what I wanted
yeah.
to say. The new, you're just another Halifax. So we can get people
Yeah,
thinking in those
exactly,
terms, because that's what
exactly.
really starts these wars. Because really, if you look at it, the standard historical account simply doesn't make sense. That
Right.
these things would occur. But so I want to thank you for coming on the show.
And there's plenty more to be said, even if after you read my book, if you like what you read, by all means, Order the Forced War, When Peaceful Revision Failed, by David L. Hogan from the Institute for Historical Review.
Yes, Mark Wilkerson.
It's a very nice edition. It's all been redone. The first edition's been out of print for years and years. And this has like a new bibliography, a new index. It's really
Well,
a handsome book.
we talk about Nazis and book burning and all that, right? Right. Well,
Yeah.
sorry, w weren't the original plates for this book destroyed in a bombing of the IRS
Oh, that's
headquarters?
true. Yes. The book actually came out in the German language years and years before the English edition came out. And it was of course it was despised and hated by the West German establishment, but it was greeted with gratitude by a lot of, ordinary patriotic Germans. Let me read this, the very end of my review,
Sure.
and it's also almost the last words in Hogan's book. He says, "The German people especially have been laden with an entirely unjustifiable burden of guilt. It may be safely said that this is the inevitable consequence of English wars, which for centuries have been waged for allegedly moral purposes." That's not just true of the English, it's true of us. It seems to be, I guess, an Anglo-Saxon trait. We're always trying to save the world from a new Hitler. But Hogan's book was released in 61 in German. It didn't come out in English until 1989. It was going to be published by Devin Adair, then they withdrew, they got into quarrel with the author, and then it was turned over to the Institute for Historical Review, and they were setting it up in type, and they were bombed. Their offices were bombed by the Jewish Defense League in, I think it was 1984, was that? And that delayed publication of the English edition for another several years. So it came out in a somewhat ramshackle edition in 1989. And that edition, the first English edition of the Forced War, and then that's been out of print for years, and this is an expanded and much improved edition that you can get from them today. It's just came out a few weeks ago.
So their building was bombed. They get their headquarters and houses bombed to prevent simply
That's right.
publishing material. I mean,
1984, which destroyed the book's layout and proof sheets, artwork, and other key files, delayed publication for about 5 years. Yeah.
yeah. So there you go.
Yeah.
So listen, Roger, I want to thank you for coming on the show.
All right. I hope that people enjoy it.
It was a good talk, and I'll publish you soon. And when I do, I'll send you the link.
Okay, that'll be great.
Good
Thank you
night,
very
then.
much.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.